So I've personally found it very helpful to practice together today. I feel a little bit more human and grounded and present. due to being together, just this collective presence of going into this form together and entering the silence and then the schedule and allowing that to carry us and helping us to slow down and to unhook from the momentum of what we usually, or I am usually sort of kind of wedded into, momentum of what's going on around in the world, and then the reactivity around that, and it's quite stressful, really, a lot of it, and having travelled to and changing just recently, a couple of weeks ago, a bit less, changing hemispheres and continents, climates. It takes a while to arrive and to land. It's a bit like teaching in our little hermitage in the mountains of KwaZulu-Natal on the border of Lesotho in South Africa. It's a bit like, and then arriving here, it's like getting off a bamboo bicycle and stepping into a Rolls Royce. It's a little stunning, really, the level of fine attunement to run these retreats here. You know, see all the work that's gone in over many years to get that level of subtlety and sensitivity to what's needed to help support a container for this work. So when one sits in that presence, sits in this hall, and we all sit in this together, we're sitting in a history of quite a lot of depth practice, and it's very helpful, and it's very, very lovely. It's a bit more raw where we usually practice Dhammagiri, a bit more turbulent. It's a slightly hanging on by one's fingernails feeling. it's very real in many ways because of that, but it is nice to come into this environment and feel also in the land here there's a lot more stillness and settledness. In where we are in South Africa, it feels very, even though the land is very ancient, the mountains are very ancient, the original peoples there, the Khoisan, San peoples, who left their paintings, which we can observe right on the mountain where Dhammagiri is. In the mountain, there's the rain beast that they painted on the back of the mountain. It still feels like that mythical being lives within the mountain. The shaman would control that to help control the weather patterns. The mountain is called Umvuleni, which means place of rain, also place of openings, and there's definitely a lot of very dramatic weather patterns, which all adds to the sense of that turbulence, big storms, thunderstorms, lightning, rain, very everyday, the skies change quite dramatically often. So it's coming into this atmosphere and just feeling this stability. And it's nice, although it's it's constructed. It's a constructed stability so that we can do this work together. And these retreats, they're very important spaces, but we're not under the illusion that the world around us is that stable. Probably never was that stable. certainly doesn't feel very stable now. So much is really on the precipice. And that in and of itself is stressful, very activating for our bodies, for our minds and our emotions. The body is an earth body and it feels very deeply. Whether it's we're conscious of that or not, it feels and resonates with what's happening in the earth, what's happening in the human. The mind is part of a web of human consciousness. So being plugged into all of that generates nowadays, I think, for a lot of people, a lot of very difficult and hard to be with responses and reactions, which is healthy actually to feel what's happening, even if it's not easy to feel that. But it's not so healthy to be activated and into patterns of stress and reactivity and overwhelm, which is what can very easily happen when things are so unstable and we lose touch with the ground. So this is a very important space, and I'm very grateful that we can do this work. I'm very grateful to all the people that helped this happen and have helped this happen. Because I know what goes into supporting Dharma centers. It's a lot of labor of love and sweat and tears. And they're complex spaces to actually hold and to sustain. They're sort of unique spaces in a way. And we don't see the underbelly of that so much when we sit in the hall or the work that's gone on, but we can feel it. So I hope that during this week we can really take advantage, and that you particularly, having taken the time out and committed your time and energy and resources to come here, can really allow this space to support you and to nourish you and to rejuvenate you, both by being in the silence and being together here, and also for us all to contemplate and use the teachings and practices of this really wonderful and holy Dharma. It's a great privilege, really, to have access to this and to be able to have the security enough to do this work. There's so many beings that don't have that, as we've seen recently, just people fleeing from war zones and trying to flood into Europe and other places. I read a poem the other day of a woman from Syria that had, you know, it's a very poignant poem where she talks about that, you know, she wants to put makeup on and went out and had children and had a husband, still has children, had a husband and had a job and friends and sit in the cafe and just like us, and then finds themselves taught English in university and then finds themselves stranded as a migrant, refugee, and people treating her as if she's some sort of alien, speaking very slow English, although she's fluent, assuming that she doesn't know what she knows. And it's just, you know, a flick of fate, really, that's not our situation right now. Could be one day. It's all very uncertain, but it's not right now. We have instead this kind of a space and this sort of support. And we take it for granted very easily, and that's a privilege, really, to be able to do that. But the Buddhist teaching, he taught for us to very much be real about the human condition and to know that this life that we have is like a flame, a candle flame in the wind. That wasn't Elton John that said that. That was actually originally the Buddha. He ripped it off. But it is flickering, you know, this lifespan. And so in this practice, we are here to be present and to enjoy the support and to relax and to be nourished. But we're also here to awaken to use these teachings to awaken, and to part of that awaken is to be more real in all meanings and levels of that word, both realistic about what is involved in our human incarnation, particularly in terms of the uncertainty that we face, that we live within, and to learn to be more open to that rather than so defended from it, so that we can, you know, develop a deeper refuge and skill in working and allowing the impact of the truth of uncertainty to mature us and bring forth very important human qualities like compassion and wisdom, but also to really enter what is real, actually, to use this time, because this was the quest of the Buddha, to use this time not in vain, but to use this time that we have in our human birth to contemplate what is real, what is a real refuge, and how can that inform us in ways of being here in this life, in this world. So the practice being real begins by being present. So in essence, although there's a lot of stuff to say about the Dharma, in essence it's actually something very simple about it. It's a simple practice of being present. And though it's very simple, it's not always necessarily that easy. Because of the momentum of what pulls us, and the habits of the mind, and the difficulty of being with what's gone before as we stop and feel that energetically within our body and within our moods and within the states of mind. And we're under the sway a lot of the time of an illusion, of many illusions. And one of those illusions is that somewhere in the future it's going to be better, or we're going to get there, whatever there means. We have a sort of list, probably an internal list of what there is and what configures a sense of arriving to there. And we chase that elusiveness, you know, that elusive place, either in our meditation, that elusive there, you know, deep jhana or liberation, whatever metaphors that we work within, or in our life, in our world. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of human consciousness is bound into this. We're getting there. You sort of have to wonder eventually where that is exactly, because you know, here we are, we wanted to get to the retreat, and here we are, and we're probably already planning how to get out of it or maybe the next one. Yeah, so if we don't awaken to that momentum, then we're actually caught in it, we're caught in that illusion, and it robs us, actually undermines us from really being here and being more real. So this presence, because the irony is, even if we get there in the future, it so happens that we're still here, because there really isn't a future, actually. You know, there is, you know, we project that and live towards that, but it's always here, even when we arrive there, it's still here. Which is one of the illusions that we have. So, in, you know, we begin to see that as we slow down and we stop, and to disinvest ourselves from that illusion and from that momentum, stop putting so much investment in it. That's not to say we can't strategically plan and so on. That can happen, but emotionally, psychologically, on every other level, to invest so heavily in an outcome and hoping that will resolve everything, and realizing that, you know, at a certain point we begin to realize the fallacy of that to some degree, and allow ourselves to really instead, you know, be here. as fully as we can. So this is being present, is the practice of being mindful. This word now that's there out in the society, translated from the original term, mindfulness, not actually perhaps optimum translation, but I don't think we can do much about that anymore. It's been pretty cemented. But the sati or smriti in Sanskrit has this meaning of remembering, or gathering back, or remembering to be here. Remember, bring back what has been split into here, into this reality. Because even if we're, in the future and we're here, there is one consistent reality. And that is this consciousness, is something that's always here. So when we're asleep, that appears in a different level of consciousness, but what is always here, whether we're in the future or when we were in the past, or we're thinking about past and future, is that's dependent upon here, and that here is dependent upon being conscious and being present here. So to remember to be conscious, or that which enables us to remember, is consciousness itself. This is a practice to be conscious. As Kirisara was saying yesterday, the training in mindfulness begins, training of returning here in the simplicity of being conscious. Begins by learning to withdraw our attention from its usual preoccupations. And so when the sutta opens with the training of the four foundations of mindfulness, it encourages, first thing, is to learn to withdraw the from the longing and the clinging and the covetousness and the grief for the world. So today we've been practicing that. Because, certainly when we think about the world, it evokes those, generally speaking, it tends to evoke those kinds of energies, those responses, a sense of longing for something, a sense of covetousness, something we still want to get, and also disappointment for what didn't quite happen. And, perhaps increasingly, as we understand what's happening in our world more and more profoundly and get more real about that, perhaps a deep sense of grief for many things that are beyond our control, and we have to witness too terrible things that are going down. So it can be a grief. And yet, it's really real to feel those things and to experience that, and yet there's a way of being present where we can be with the world without being so pulled into a suffering around the world. It doesn't mean to say we can't feel, we can't honour what we feel, we can't respond, but there's a practice. This practice of mindfulness, as the Buddha said, is for the purification of beings, is for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, is for the disappearance of suffering and grief, is for the attainment of the true way, a way of awakening, and for the realization of nibbana, of that which actually is untouched by change, untouched by death, untouched by impermanence. Realization of the nibbana, the amata dhatu, as Kirisara mentioned last night, this deathless element, the unchanging. It's for that, most subtly, that this practice of mindfulness was taught by the Buddha as a pathway, as a way into this realization. realization begins with very simply of withdrawing the mind and being here as best we can. And in a way, that's it. I mean, there is a lot more to it, but essentially, it's that simple, to just show up as best we can for what's here. And in this practice, in this particular focus, this part of the retreat, to show up for ourselves, actually. This thing we call ourself, this body and the feelings and the momentum of the habits and history that we're with, all of that. It's like, you know, trying to steady within the flow of momentum, movement, steadying through this practice of being conscious. This consciousness that actually brings reality. It's this consciousness that's real. This consciousness has the attribute, being conscious has the attribute of awareness, or it's called buddhi, which means a knowingness. It's a knowing awareness, intelligence. Not necessarily the kind of academic intelligence about knowing lots of stuff. That's one kind of intelligence, but just in a way it's more to do with unknowing, I suppose, a sort of a stripping away of all that we know and assume to be the case, because we often live much more through our assumptions than through what's really here. So the knowingness is a kind of a nakedness, perhaps, in relationship to being here. It's a way of realizing we're here, but perhaps we're here and we don't really know what this is all about, what's going on, you know, because it is a little strange, this thing called life. And I don't know why we think we know what's going on, because, you know, most of the time I don't know what's going on. I'm sure most people don't really know, but we pretend we know what's going on. That's pretty, you know, that's probably quite good that we do, otherwise we might completely freak out. Like, oh, what's going on? This is so weird. So to be real is okay, to realize it's not a sort of personality failure. It's actually being real, to know we don't know always, can't quite grasp it, keeps eluding us, keeps shape-shifting. And yet when we actually open to that, there's something quite grounding, a relief. Because what we can know, what we can be with, is just this invitation to be present. To be present. As the Buddha said, is that in this being present, it's actually beginning to recognize what is real. Because we take what is unreal to be real, and what is real to be unreal. What is unreal, we think, is real. It's not that things are really unreal, but there's a sort of, you know, the dreams and the thoughts and the ideas and the momentum of our life and our memories and the projections into the future, all of that we take to be very, very real. All the stories, all the histories, layers and layers of it. It's very powerful, has a very powerful reality and shaping of the mind. And not only of the projected world outside, but even of the projected inner world of the self. We assume all sorts of narratives as true about ourselves. All sorts of things that we've been told, or we heard, or we've created stories about ourselves. You know, and we have, they're not exactly untrue. You know, our identities, our roles, our psychology, our different ways that we would define ourselves. But you can't really hold it, you can't really grasp it. And if you look through the eye of insight, you have to acknowledge that there's a sort of flimsiness there and transparency that doesn't really hold. It doesn't really ultimately define and capture the definition of yourself or the world or each other. But we live within definitions, and it's very limiting of who we think we are and who we think everyone else is. And in the same way, what is actually real, this very stark and unbounded, undefined presence of consciousness, conscious awareness, we assume is not that real. We don't give it any credibility, and yet without that, nothing else would exist. If we weren't conscious, we wouldn't be aware now. So as one great saint, Sri Nisargadatta, said, great realized being, he said, it's a bit like, you know, when you, as a metaphor for getting a sense of this territory, it's a bit like when we go to a movie theater and you see the screen and it's playing projected as a projection of light and sound and image, and it creates a narrative on this screen. And then we get very, very engrossed in that narrative, and we weep and we get frightened and we react and we cry, and then suddenly it stops. And it's like, oh, that was so real, wasn't it? When we were there in the movie, it was so very, very real. And we talk about it and we give Oscars and so on. And yet when it stops, the movie stops, there's just the blank screen. And you know, and what enabled that to actually be projected, if we turned round and looked at the projector, we'd see actually there's this light that projects, and from that light then it projects through a prism of forms and colours and narrative. This is a little bit like this consciousness, you know, projecting, it's projecting the mind, projecting the stories that we have and that we live within. So they're so very real. I mean, I do think I remember being in South Africa, and there's certain things there that I really am engrossed in. You know, the narratives, the politics, the social, economic processes, the, you know, all the things that go on there, and the hermitage, and suffer like mad about some of it and get elated about some of it. Love it. Then I leave and it's like, well, where did that go? Can't hardly remember it. But it's real. It's real when we're in it. You know, but then, you know, I start to sit and practice, and then it, you know, it starts to dissolve. You dissolve, and you start to see the space, like that blank screen, the space that's happening within of this mind. And then behind that, there's just this illumination. What's illuminating it is this conscious awareness. So this practice of being real, of remembering, of returning, of showing up, of being present, is the practice of being aware, conscious. But withdrawing the mindfulness, the training of attention, which in a way is like at the, I don't know, you can't really define spatially consciousness. You can't really define consciousness by any ways that we usually define things, in time or in space, or by any particular quality. Perhaps this knowingness is the most you could say, perhaps. Knowingness has a knowingness about it, but you could say central, although that's just a metaphor, is this attentiveness, is an attention, you know, just mindfulness. Or sometimes I like to think it as the outpost of conscious awareness, because there's different levels of consciousness. We're conscious, but there's an unconscious, there's a lot we're not conscious of that maybe comes to us through dreams, or comes to us through intuition, or things that we don't even know that we feel that sometimes appear in different ways, and we realize, oh, that was unconscious to me, and now I know it's here, it's become illuminated to me. And then if we look even more deeply, in the Mahayana Sutta, they talk about the essence of consciousness, the Sharangama Sutra, essence of consciousness being pure essence of consciousness as light, brilliant, illuminating. In the Theravada, they talk about the primary luminosity of consciousness. And then there's this sort of like, even perhaps beyond that, there's a, like looking out into space. There's a profound mystery, darkness almost, like dark matter holding it all together, apparently. I don't know. It starts to get very, very strange at a certain point. When you read the quantum physicists that are exploring this territory, it's really hard to know what they're talking about, because you start to get into these really mystical spaces. One of the father of quantum physics, Max Planck, said this: all matter originates and exists only by virtue of a force. We must assume behind this force the existence of a conscious and intelligent mind. This mind is the matrix of matter. So this is like an outpost of human exploration. We've gone out into the objective world, the world of what we consider matter, and we consider matter as dead, something we exploit, something we extract from, something we explode in these great sort of, what's that thing that they're exploding atoms and quarks and so on to try and see what is actually at the heart of matter. It's all looking at it objectively, but there is this beginning to look at, well, who's looking at all of this? What's the subject? Who's the subject? And this exploration of consciousness itself, and to begin to realize this is a stunning, stunning insight, actually, that the collapse of the so-called external is different from the so-called internal. This conscious me, and it's all objective out there, and it's sort of other and different. As that starts to collapse, then they see the Buddha also talked about this collapse of subject-object. As it's a primary, the primary division generates this experience of separateness and fear and longing. As that starts to collapse, what happens? So to explore, this is what we're exploring. Exploring in the mindfulness practice, we start to use the mindfulness attention in a particular way. We start to extract ourselves from our illusions, from the momentum of the mind, by training attention around which focalizes awareness, training attention to be here in a very simple way, just to be with the body. For example, this is where we're starting today. Being with body and breath. So it's a we're not really that often in this way with our bodies. We're more often with our bodies through our the prism of our assumptions and our beliefs and our conditioning and our reactivity. So we sort of live a little bit removed from the body. And we have all sorts of views about our body, all sorts of ways that we relate to it, mostly often quite unconsciously. It's just this thing that goes along until it plays up and it draws our attention. We sort of put food in and water and excretes and so on. But it's a very different practice, a very interesting way that the Buddha began this journey into reality by coming, not saying this is matter, it's not important, we're just going to go into some little rose cloud of spiritual thing, you know, and just float away in some nirvanic peace. I mean, that's what I first wanted to do when I came across meditation. I just wanted to get on a cloud, nice, lovely cloud, and just float away. Bye, sweet world. It's nice knowing you. Can't get out quick enough. You know, so it was, I have to confess, it was a shock to be sit in one of these 10 days retreats and just be told over and over again, go to the sensations of your body. It was like, no way did I want to do that. It wasn't easy. It's not easy to be embodied. You know, we spend a lot of time being disembodied. But it's very profound. And it's very healing. It's very healing because we're actually coming into relationship. The mindfulness removes us from a false relationship into a direct relationship to our actual experience. So we're sort of moving from, you know, the projections onto this body. Very complex to work through or to even be aware of, because there's a lot of views that we pick up that basically say there's an ideal kind of body and this isn't it. And I don't know anyone, even if we might think, well, they've got a great body, usually internally there's still this feeling it isn't it. Yeah, so we can assume that no one feels that they have the ideal body. Or if you do, it's a very fleeting, momentary delusion. Bound up with suffering. So these are bodies, and this is what they're like, you know. And so first thing is mindfulness, is just allowing us to open to our embodied experience as it is, and seeing the body less through the prism of a me, and what I want it to be, how I feel it should be according to the social conditioning, to the industry, billion-dollar industry that feeds off our discontent and lack of acceptance of our embodied appearance, which is all very cynical, really. You know, to come into relationship with the body by being able to feel the body breathing. Like when we were doing the Qigong today, we just at the end, you know, we just put our hands over our heart. And I always find that part of the end of the Qigong practice, because I feel when I do that, I feel the fluttering of the heartbeat and the breath, and it all feels rather fragile. It all feels rather, you know, I just feel a sense of momentary love. I don't often have a sense of love for my body, but for a moment, maybe just by actually bringing the hands and feeling the breath, I'm in touch with the realness of my body, of this body. And it's, you know, it's a very sort of softening experience, softening the mind. So in this practice, you know, we're really encouraging ourselves in this first foundation to come into relationship, first of all, with our body in a very kind way. You know, often on these retreats we go through the gathering practice, samadhi, the insight practice, wisdom, and then we sort of like tack on the end, now this is the metta day. But really we should begin with this quality of kindness. Metta, the Sanskrit word, maitri, it means literally to soften, but in particular a softening of the heart. A softening around the defenses that we have and the hardness that we hold, the views that we have, the judgments that projected I mean, they project outward, but they fiercely project inward on, you know, what's not good enough. Body's not good enough. What I'm feeling's not right. Meditation's not good enough. It's a sort of ongoing litany of not good enoughs. It's quite sad, really, that we all tend to be conditioned so profoundly in not feeling good enough. And I think it's partly to do with this split where the sacred has been removed from the embodied, from matter, consciousness. And consciousness, in a way, it's the space of the sacred. So just this very simple practice of being with the body and breathing, it's like a reclamation. We're reclaiming a sort of sacredness, which is in a world that's devoid of that. Because we don't feel the sacred, then we can abuse the world of matter. I love this story, and I know some of you have heard it, but when a friend of ours who was a monastic was in hospital in Bangkok, practicing as a monk, and he had, as we all did in those early days, had all these internalized ideas of what it was to be a sort of really tough practitioner. And being in hospital with his knees in plaster and having knee operations and the possibility of not sitting cross-legged again in this perfect posture was really not on his agenda as the ideal for what it would be to be a sort of tough monk. So he's feeling very, very sorry for himself in this state, you know, imagining himself sitting in an armchair where everyone else is sitting on just a thin cloth and sitting there all night in this sort of perfect posture, and he'd have to sit on some sort of, in the northeast of Thailand, in those monasteries, that really wasn't that on. Wasn't considered that good practice, sit on a chair. So anyway, sitting, laying there feeling very sorry, and Ajahn Chah, a teacher from a wonderful master, came to see him and sort of leaned over and said, "How's it going?" And he said, "Oh, Ajahn Chah, it shouldn't be like this, really shouldn't be like this." And Ajahn Chah looked him up and down and said, "Well, you know, if it shouldn't be like this, it really wouldn't be like this." so we approach our experience. This is a lack of metta. It's a very deeply programmed judgment about how it shouldn't be. We know we really could write a big essay about how it shouldn't be. And how it should be. And metta doesn't imply that we approve of how it is, or we like how it is, but the softening means a profound acceptance of how it is. It doesn't either mean that we're not going to change how it is, but sometimes unless we can really accept and hear how it is, then our efforts to change how it is come from aversion and aggression, even subtle. We have this very subtle Buddhist aggression, passive aggression. I'm being very Buddhist. I said, "Would you please mind if you could back off?" Lots of metta. It doesn't mean to say that we can't change or we can't have strength or we can't challenge. But we begin in this sort of safe space, beginning with this being ourselves. When we become more real, we come bring this consciousness, this extraordinary gift of self-awareness that can reflect. Being mindful is also another way of saying can reflect on our experience wisely. Is to really deeply. Can we accept how it is? in each moment. And that's a part of the practice, it's a repetition. We repeat, it's not like we just do it once and then we go into that shape, because we go back into the shape of our reactivity. So it's a repeating practice. How is it now? Take a deep breath into how is it now. You know, maybe there's resistance, maybe there's tiredness, maybe there's, you know, it's enough now. Maybe there's peace. But before we start reacting and struggling, it's like the metta, the softening, the opening into how it is, the accepting, the allowing. And this begins to ground us in a very, very powerful way. It brings its own strength, its own freedom. So I believe that Kirisara mentioned last night the journey of the Buddha, which is a very archetypal journey in so many ways, in the moment when he tried to crush everything he was feeling, this body, tried to starve it, tried to remove himself from its demands, even the breathing. Try to remove himself from contact. Try to control consciousness into refined, subtle states and not experience coarse states. And realizing in the end, he just came out with a statement saying this is a something like actually, I can't remember, but something like this is a useless way. There's no fruit in this. I'm sure there's some fruit, you know, you learn some patience, some strength, but it's not the way of a liberation, joy of freedom. And then the moment we said, might there be another way? And then he had the dream, the memory. It's like this moment when we give up. And there's into that, it's again that space of not having to know it all, not having to control it all, not having to have a strategy, just being open. It's a sort of like the necessary movement to then allow what happened for him is a memory that led him into a radically different way. If that hadn't have happened, we wouldn't have the teaching that we're using and we'll be using on this retreat all these years later. And that was just came out of completely a different space, place, which was the memory of the child. And it's a very, you know, archetypally that's a very powerful image, something childlike, open. Surely we must remember, you know, those moments of awe. I used to, you know, we can all think of childhood, maybe all the struggles and difficulties, but also, there's something very innocent and open. I used to love to, with my father, look up at the night sky and just, I didn't have a particularly easy relationship with my father, but that was one of the moments, and we would just go, wow, wow, it's a mystery. That sort of open mind. So it's a quality of being present, but with an open mind, curious, hasn't got it all worked out. But also another incident happened at that moment, which was also completely out of the mystery, wasn't strategy. And that was when Sujata came to him. Sujata was this woman, she'd been watching this guy, Siddhartha, doing all these ascetic practices and quite admiring, like, wow, he's really tough, he's really sincere, he's pretty committed. But she also saw him falling over. Sorry about that. When he was nearly dying, you know, as Kisara was saying, he scratched his tummy and he felt his backbone, he scratched his head and his hair would fall out, etc., etc. So, you know, she thought, well, you know, I better give this guy something to eat. So she bought some milk rice, as the story goes, and offered it to the Buddha. And of course, his five fellow ascetics, who became the first five disciples later on in the story, they looked at him and said, oh, this is really, I can't believe that he's thinking of accepting this to eat something and from a woman. It's disgraceful. But the Buddha in that moment, you know, maybe his mind was very open. And it's a sort of, again, it's a metaphor, an archetypal moment of the feminine, a woman representing embodiment, the earth, world of form, offering nourishment. Take nourishment, because you're not going to do this if you don't nourish yourself. You're going to die. You know? And, you know, a moment he realized, might there be another way? This was part of the other way. So he accepted that, took nourishment, had the strength then to continue on to Buddh Gaya, or Gaya, sat under the tree, which was then led to his awakening. At which point, because he had done that, he was abandoned by his ascetics. And perhaps it was a merciful moment because he was left completely alone then. Completely freed from all known ways to explore this journey of consciousness. And so archetypally, in a way, it's this moment from moving from this control, warrior, being in charge, thinking one's knowing where one's going, into more the archetype of the lover, the softening, the opening, the unknowing, the receptive, the mystery. So it's an important metaphor for us in our journey of practice. To become present implies all of that, to be present. And to be present in a particular way, yes, there's a tension. There is a skill in withdrawing the mind from its preoccupations, from its investments in the future, from its grief and sorrow for the past, disappointment. It is a practice to again and again and again to withdraw the mind and come to this one breath, a deep breath, feeling the body, arriving into our embodied experience. So that's a skill, and yet within that there's also this softening, there's this willingness to surrender into just the simplicity of not having to know it all, of just being willing to show up, to be present here. Like that lover energy means this deep accepting, allowing of our body, particularly, and what's felt. As we start to engage that with our contemplative awareness, allowing the awareness to contemplate the experience. It's like this. And then sometimes the unexpected comes to visit. Another thing Nisargadatta, this great realized being, said that reality comes in the unexpected. It's nice to contemplate that, not necessary from our strategies. So tomorrow morning, we'll be offering, for those that would like to join us, you're very welcome to join us. And you're also very welcome not to do this practice if it doesn't speak to you, in which case you can join us a bit later for the sitting, the early sitting. But for the very first practice in the morning will be a bowing practice. If for 10 minutes. And you can come and just listen, you can sit and just listen. You can bow the full-length bow that we'll be doing if you wish. You can just do a half-length bow according to what your body capacity is. We're using a mantra, and we have a recording of that mantra. It's quite a complex melody. It's from a Chinese monastic school, Mahayana school. The mantra is to Kuan Yin, Namo Kuan Shu Yin Pu Sa. And that mantra is second on the mantra page. It's the second mantra. It says Namo Kuan Shu Yin Pu Sa. The Dabe in brackets, parentheses, isn't, we don't recite that. Namo, I pay homage. Sometimes translated as I return my life. Kuan is the one that regards, listens to. Yin is sound. Sure, it's the world, the one that regards the sounds of the world. So this is another way of talking about conscious presence. The intelligence of profound, compassionate, merciful, responsive heart. Aware heart, Kuan Yin. Ultimately, we have these beautiful statues here, Kuan Yin, beautiful one there of her holding her wish-fulfilling pearl, one at the back. But Kuan Yin isn't a statue. Kuan Yin is the alive, conscious, aware, intelligent, responsive, listening heart. So when we bow, we're bowing into that heart. We're taking all our strategies, all our fears, all our worries, all our hopes, all our disappointments. We take all of that back in the bow into this listening, into this presence, and we allow ourselves to trust that. We put our trust there. Because it's this heart, this intelligence, this awareness, this reality that will show us another way.